this week's 51%, we hear about women veterans running for Congress and meet a military spouse whose company focuses on other military spouses.
A customer, when they pick up one of our handbags, they're really picking up an entire community of women and believing in the modern-day woman and the modern-day American woman.
Plus, we jump into the world of women's wrestling. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. In the 1960s, about 75% of the members of Congress were veterans. Now that percentage has dropped to 19%. But this year, dozens of former service members are running for congressional seats, including an unprecedented number of female veterans. Reporters Carson Frame and Bobby O'Brien look at how that's playing out in one Texas district.
Democratic congressional candidate M.J. Hagar, an Air Force veteran, wants to flip a Republican district that includes Fort Hood, one of the country's largest military bases. She kicked off her campaign with a video that earned more than 4 million views online and raised about $750,000.
I was on a rescue mission in Afghanistan as a combat search and rescue pilot. I heard the windshield crack and realized I'd been shot.
Grounded by the attack, Hagar tried to get a different job in air support. But Pentagon policy at that time barred women from combat. So Hagar challenged it in court and won. Now, as she runs for Congress, Hagar says she put her military service at the center of her campaign, not as a strategic move, but as a reflection of who she is.
I have a record of putting this country ahead of myself.
She says military experience isn't the only thing that defines a candidate, but veterans have seen a lot and worked with all kinds of people and can help bridge political and social divides.
We're at a record low number of veteran representatives in Congress, and it's no coincidence that we're at a record high level of toxic hyperpartisanship of people who put themselves first and can't seem to agree on pragmatic solutions.
At a campaign event in Austin, Democrats Deborah Coe and Suzanne Rockmore said Hagar has the kind of background that can help their party win control of Congress.
She's not afraid of nothing. She's fierce, and that's what we need.
I think she's got the heart of a warrior, you know?
This is Bobby O'Brien in Tampa. Hagar is one of more than 400 veterans who have run for Congress this year, though some have already lost their primaries. More than 12% of the nominees in the general election are women veterans so far. Norm Bonnieman is with Veterans Campaign, a nonpartisan organization that trains veterans to run for office. He says politics can be a tough transition coming from a military environment where there is no I in team.
You're out there in a very nasty and polarized political environment. That's a big change to what most of our constituents saw in the military. So, you know, while they have a lot of the leadership traits that a lot of folks are interested in seeing in their elected officials, those barriers to entry are very high.
The barriers Bonnieman is talking about, veterans often have little experience raising money and may lack the political connections they need to get party support. They also move around a lot and might not have deep ties to a community. And then there are the gerrymandered, less competitive districts that make it hard for anyone to beat an incumbent. Political scientist Jeremy Tigan from Ramapo College of New Jersey wrote the book Why Veterans Run.
You can run a very compelling candidate with a military biography, but you can't move a plus 20 Republican district into the Democrats' column with merely changing the biography of your candidate.
So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to our Congressman John Carter.
Meanwhile, back in Texas, Congressman John Carter is the 15-year incumbent campaigning against M.J. Hagar. He's not a veteran, but often advocates for them, like when he recently presented medals to a World War II veteran at an American Legion post.
Sir, I am honored to be in your presence. Thank you for your service to our country.
My overall congressional experience has been heavily centered on veterans' affairs. By their very nature, soldiers and the military demands more attention, and I'm glad to give it to them.
During the campaign, Carter has said little about Hagar's military experience. But Carter has run against veterans before and never lost.
I think we rise or fall on our accomplishments of our lives, and that's generally how I run my race, whoever I'm running against.
In this heavily Republican district, several veterans at the American Legion post said Hagar's military experience still is unlikely to make them vote for a Democrat. Analysts say Carter remains the favorite in the race. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
And I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Meantime, Lisa Bradley is remembering a veteran lawmaker, Senator John McCain, who recently died at age 81 from brain cancer. Bradley says the Republican from Arizona who had served as a Navy pilot was a champion for the plight and sacrifices of military spouses and families. McCain was part of a bipartisan effort to help with employment for military spouses, and a provision he had worked on with Democratic Virginia Senator Tim Kaine was in the recently signed John S. McCain National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2019. Bradley, herself a military spouse, is co-founder of R. Riveter, a company created by military spouses for military spouses.
So Senator McCain was a huge part of bringing forward two bills that have really helped military spouses. So the first one's Military Spouse Employment Act, and then also the Child Care for Military Families Act. And those have really helped bring forward the light of military spouses having difficulty finding employment. And also is one of the big reasons why my co-founder and I started the company R. Riveter.
So before we dive into R. Riveter, maybe you could talk about why these provisions are important to you.
The two bills that John McCain was able to put forward really helps military spouses in finding job opportunities. So 40% of military spouses have college degrees, but 16% of military spouses are actually unemployed. So you see that across the board, military spouses are higher educated, qualified for jobs, but because of the constant moves and licensing regulations, on average have very high unemployment rates. They actually have 16% unemployment as compared to only 4.1% of national unemployment. So we really see the need for lawmakers and policymakers to be able to help military spouses find jobs, and that's really what Senator McCain really pushed for. On the child care side, the affordable child care. So they found that the lack of access to affordable child care drives unemployment for military spouses up even higher. So the provision would be able to require the Department of Defense to implement a program to increase the number of child care providers by around each duty station.
So what else needs to be done?
Well, we've really seen one of the big areas that we really see that the needle could be moved on military spouse unemployment is really encouraging other small businesses to hire military spouses. And that's really where we would see a big difference, because there's so many small businesses. And if we could break down some of the barriers for them to be able to hire more military spouses, such as taxation and nexus across different states, we'd really see more small businesses being able to take on military spouses who have to move across state line frequently.
Obviously, a military spouse does not necessarily have to be a woman, so I just wanted to point that out.
Right, yeah, 92% of military spouses are female, so we tend to speak in majority, but for sure there's a great amount of military spouses that are men as well.
Okay, so meantime, you're doing your part to fill that void being military spouses gainfully employed.
Right, exactly. The high military spouse unemployment, it does compromise the quality of the military families and the ability for the military member to be able to go overseas and do what they need to do for us. So as a country and protecting our freedom. So what we want to do is be able to provide income to military spouses in specific, which helps us across the board from the military family retention rate, as well as the military spouse and having self-identity with the multiple moves. I know myself as a military spouse, I moved 5 times by the time I was 25. And so that was really at the core of really creating a foundation of what I was going to be doing for a living. And I worked really hard to get a degree, and I just kind of saw myself becoming highly educated but underexperienced. And so we saw this need and we said, you know, let's stop complaining about it and create a business that provides income opportunities to military spouses that first and foremost is mobile and flexible. So we started the company back in 2011, and we named it R. Riveter after Rosie the Riveter. And she is the World War II icon that really stepped up to the plate in a time that our country really needed it. So when the men in their lives were called to defend our nation, they didn't stand on the sidelines. They stood up, jumped full force into working in the economy and propelling our country forward. And they really found purpose in their work. And so that's a huge part of why we we as military spouses want to do our part as well. And being part of the economy, being part of the community of supporting each other, that's really what our company stands for. So the company is actually headquartered in North Carolina, but the manufacturing, and this is the unique part, takes place all across the country. So the military spouses are at home making the parts and pieces to our handbag line. So they're creating the liners, they're creating the shell, they're punching out the leather. And each time that they make a part, they actually are stamping their maker number in it. And then they drop ship those parts and pieces out to us in North Carolina where our products are assembled. But it's really coming together of a community of women that are coming together. Up to 12 military spouses go into making each one of our products. And really a representation of how we can come together as a country and all work towards one common goal.
Are you finding that the way you're conducting this business is cutting into your bottom line?
You know, when we first started this company, so many people said it's never going to work. Why would you increase your costs in order to ship parts back and forth all across the country? And we said that, you know, it's really what makes us be able to make something here in the United States and be able to provide income to military spouses. So it's really what makes us unique and what makes us relevant. And so we absolutely take on the extra costs in order to produce a very high quality product made in the United States by a very deserving group of women.
And how many employees do you have?
We have 40 employees, and then we also, the riveters, who are the military spouses across the country, they own their own business creating those parts and pieces, and we actually have near 50 of them now. It's a decentralized manufacturing process. So they're at home making the parts and pieces, which is really what they need in their life. They need that mobility. They need that flexibility. And being that they're running three shifts, which is sometimes wife, mother, and a riveter, they really need to be able to do this whenever it best suits them. So they're able to do this during nap time or after a car pickup line. It's really that independent nature that they really need in their lives.
And are you profitable?
Yes, we are. We actually have grown in just tremendous amounts over the years. We went on Shark Tank in 2016 and grew over 1,400% during that time period. So it was just huge, huge support from our military families and backing us up in what we wanted to do and believed in us the whole entire way. And it's a phenomenal feeling to be able to still be able to start something in America and grow it.
How is this empowering the women? I mean, the contractors are spread across the United States, the riveters, as you call them, the independent contractors, but there is this, excuse the pun, common thread. So where's the women empowerment part of this?
Right. You know, it's about making something for each other. We have a saying that I can do it, because first and foremost, you need to believe that you can stand up and do what you believe in, and then you can do it, and then we can do it. And so there is a huge thread of women empowerment through action in our company. And we really believe in that what Rosie the Riveter stood for back in the World War II era still is alive and well today in the modern day woman. You know, we have social media telling us who and what and how we should be. And our company just really believes in creating a platform that you can do all those things. You can be a mom or a dad and have a career. Rosie the Riveter had to at one time go out of the homes, learn an unfamiliar skill set, and then and work there. We're now turning that around and taking the work opportunity back into the home where he or she can be a mom as well.
So where is our Riveter headed?
Well, our Riveter, my large aspirations is a household name brand. Whenever I can see a customer and they see another customer carrying one of our handbags, they automatically just know that they both believe in something together. And that's really what I think is so encouraging about our brand, is that a customer, when they pick up one of our handbags, they're really picking up an entire community of women and believing in the modern day woman and the modern day American woman.
Any expansion in the product line?
And yes, actually we expanded our product line on our website through a marketplace. So if you go onto our website at ourriveter.com, you can also shop a curated collection of military-made items as well as American-made and mission-driven. So what we saw is that we knew so many other military spouses that were starting their own retail line, and they just really needed a avenue in order to sell their products. So we opened up a marketplace on our website after the success of Shark Tank, and some of those military spouse companies have quadrupled, and they themselves have moved out of a garage into much larger manufacturing facilities just because of the growth from selling on our website.
So you told me earlier you have two kids, ages 5 and 2, and though obviously that's quite young, what's the benefit for them with what you're doing?
I know that I can wake up every morning and know that I've created something that military spouses can plug into. And I can also know that my kids are looking up to not just their dad, who has the coolest job in the world, jumping out of airplanes and going overseas and being kind of the modern day hero, but they can also look at their mom and be just as proud to know that you can start a company and you can be part of the economy, and that company can go back to helping other people.
That was Lisa Bradley, co-founder of R. Riveter. The world of professional wrestling is largely dominated by men, but women are increasingly getting in on the action. The groundwork was laid decades ago. Rachel Otwell brings us the stories of some of those females fighting for inclusion.
Tonight's matches feature the Royal Hawaiian and Spanish Red versus California Doll and Americana.
Throw her ass on the ground.
Oh, she looks like a pineapple.
That sound from the pilot episode of GLOW from back in the mid-80s. GLOW stands for the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. The performances are campy, over-the-top, and comedic. Patricia Summerland, a.k.a. Sunny, the California girl, had been a model from a young age. When she was 20, her dad showed her GLOW.
And I see this show with all these different sizes, shapes of females kicking each other's butt on TV. And I'm like, what? What is this?
Summerland has a background in athletics. She ran track and field, but she wasn't sure she could keep up with the flips and knockdowns she saw on TV.
And I said, oh my gosh, Dad, they're going to kill me. I can't do that. You know, and he goes, just try.
Obviously, it worked out, and Summerland became part of an institution that has earned a cult following. But getting to the point she could compete in the ring was not easy. More self-doubt followed during the grueling workout sessions.
Backward rolls, backward flips, and all these crazy things. It was like, oh my God, I can't do this.
Summerland persisted and proved to herself and others she was more than a blonde bombshell. Her character was modeled after Jane Mansfield, she says.
Now, I'm 53 years old. I can still kick butt in the ring. I won't do any high-flying maneuvers off the third turnbuckle or anything. Or, you know, I can do drop kicks. My drop kicks are better now than they were then. It's in your blood. It stays with you. It's like riding a bike.
Summerland says she's not surprised by the resurgence and attention GLOW has garnered in recent years. She's based in L.A. and is now a radio personality with devoted fans, some of whom have paid to go on cruises with her and other original GLOW wrestlers. In 2012, there was an award-winning documentary, and GLOW is also the inspiration for a Netflix series of the same name that premiered last year.
Wrestling is about type. You're a sexy party girl. You're an Arab.
You mean stereotype.
Yes, bingo, exactly. You're a big black girl. The f*** you say?
The GLOW style of wrestling has even seeped into the crevices of Central Illinois' punk subculture, as was on display earlier this year at a small music venue and bar.
ID, please, and $7 for the three bands playing tonight and the women's amateur wrestling.
Tonight, the main event is Claw, Champagne Ladies Amateur Wrestling. Here's Madeline Wolski, who heads the effort, but she goes by another name.
So I'm the Dewey Decimator, librarian from hell, and I am the big old heel of Claw.
Wolski, a.k.a. Dewey Decimator, says since its inception in 2015, Claw has become a colorful part of the local community.
People love Claw. We have been welcomed by many demographics. And surprisingly for me, a lot of even very conservative festivals have reached out to us and asked us to perform with them. People love that we're a platform for women to become empowered, but I'm extremely passionate about the fact that the majority of large shows we do are held as benefits for other small nonprofits. So what we do is we're wrestling in order to give back to the community.
Wolski and her fellow wrestlers are backed up by a band called Bookmobile that's been part of the shtick since the beginning. Luke Burkhetter is Bookmobile's drummer.
Claw is a very punk organization, you know. It's like a feminist women doing theatrical wrestling to a punk rock soundtrack, and we provide that soundtrack.
While the other bands play to a somewhat sparse dance floor, the second the wrestlers begin to prep their set, laying out mats on the stage, the area gets packed as onlookers clamor to get a good view of the performance. Camilla Glowacki is in the audience tonight. She's been to a handful of Claw shows previously, and a band she's in performed with them once. She's an art educator and a bit of a wrestling fan, turns out.
It's actually really interesting because in WWE, there's been a recent sort of empowerment and, like, women's wrestling is taken seriously.
So much so that later this fall, in October, WWE will have its first all-female pay-per-view wrestling event. Isabel Skidmore, who prefers going by gender-neutral pronouns, says they've found involvement with Claw has led to gains in self-confidence.
So I was excited to be able to, like, show that I could be strong and show that I could put on a show and be funny and, like, play a character.
Skidmore, whose wrestling character is crafted as an X-Files reference and named Spooky Scully, says one of the coolest things about Claw has been seeing the reaction from audiences. Skidmore talks about one match at a family-friendly event.
And it was really cool to see, like, young girls sitting there, like, completely enraptured and, like, watching us and, like wanting to get pictures with us afterwards. And that was just really incredible that, like, people are actually watching us and, like, we're making a difference in people's lives and people are enjoying the show that we put on. It's really, really nice and really, really rewarding.
Claw is not the only group of its kind carrying on the GLOW wrestling legacy. In L.A., a group of performance artists banded together to create 80s-style wrestling videos, and eventually matches taped before live audiences. J.J. Stratford, longtime wrestling fan, conceptualized the idea.
I'm the HBIC of Future Ladies of Wrestling.
That's right, the Future Ladies of Wrestling, a.k.a. GLOW. And in case you don't know what that HBIC acronym Stratford uses stands for,
that's the head bitch in charge.
Here's a sampling of some of the material GLOW features on their website.
Hi, I'm Candy Payne. I love wrestling. And I hate men.
Stratford says this evolution, where the old is being readapted into something new, is all about flipping the script.
Well, I think anytime you set out to create a team of women that are taking on a persona and conquering someone and going up for a big challenge, it's immediately empowering. But then if you consider the history of wrestling and things that, like, Vince McMahon did for women in wrestling, it's kind of questionable. You know, he has female wrestlers in his league, the Divas, but for years, if they do a match, they're in bikinis or they have a lingerie fight. Female wrestlers have always been kind of kept in this very sexist little box. It makes sense that in this era, that new wrestling would sprout up that wasn't a part of Vince McMahon's vision, that people like me would start a league and take this cool format and world and create it for their own.
Stratford says GLOW has been more successful than she had anticipated. The issue now is finding a venue that can contain the large crowds they pull. And she's not interested in keeping GLOW in some sort of niche category either.
So we would love to be so successful and so popular without changing anything of what we do, like still being empowering and hilarious and lo-fi or whatever you want to call it. But we want figurines made of our girls.
In the meantime, while the acclaim has a long way to go to reach that of GLOW, GLOW hopes to comfort those who may feel wary of the future.
We're living in this era where it's a little bit scary what's going to happen, especially to women. We thought that everything's a bit doom and gloom, or, you know, especially around women's issues. We wanted to project this, like, future where, yeah, the women were equal, if not in charge, and also just give it a little bit of a utopian view, since this is a very dystopian reality. We want to kind of give people something to look forward to.
Regardless of their politics, fans of women's wrestling have an increasingly equitable playing field to watch over in the months and years ahead. For 51%, I'm Rachel Otwell.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1520.